care of that. Okay. Oh, and also, there was a second announcement. I forgot. There was one here. Rena has volunteered to coordinate meals. So if you get into a situation where you need any help of any kind, particularly meals, but I mean, if you need other help, you can always let us know. If you're gonna, you're sick or whatever, see her, and then I'll make the announcement, and she can be responsible for setting up whatever schedule we need, whether it's a few days or should somebody become hospitalized or something. It could be longer, obviously. So, but then we can apply in that area. Okay, let's make sure you are in fellowship here, and let's continue on then. Actually, we're just going to wrap this up pretty quickly here and get back to the text. We were down to point E under Roman numeral 12, concluding observations. Each believer, that should be in there, should give with the right mental attitude. As we pointed out, things done out of fellowship with the wrong attitude is not rewardable. One should give to the proper objects. Again, these objects are determined for us by the priorities of doctrine, not by our own personal opinions. We set what the doctrinal priorities are as we see them in the Scripture. And so we have these responsibilities that extend outward. As we know, first and foremost, the first thing is the local church. Then you have, obviously, your own initial niche that's right, you know, whatever involves that. The people around you, then your family, as we saw, say your aged parents come into need and you have to help them out financially, that would be a legitimate object of giving. And then outward again, even to the final edges, the legitimate poor out here. And obviously, again, these priorities are established for us, and one should seek to take these seriously, think about them, pray about them, decide, okay, how do I want to apply, where, when. One of the things with giving to the legitimate poor we've talked about is finding out, you know, who the legitimate poor are, that you're giving to the right person, and all of that. You're not, you know, don't want to support, you know, a crackhead or whatever else. Three, from the source of right priorities. Again, we suggest that the Scripture set the priorities for us, and we just simply follow those. Four, from prayerful consideration of God's will with respect to the amount, what one gives. In a particular setting, it could vary. One might give a large amount. One might be led to give a small amount. And each believer could be equally in fellowship and making the proper application. That's why, again, as we've pointed out, there's really no place for judging at all in any of these things, but certainly not in regard to giving. Because one does not know what resources God has provided for the believer, what God's will is in the matter, and while it's easy to walk around and think you know the will of God for everybody else, you don't. None of us do. And consistency has to be a part of this, as we saw set forth there in the Jerusalem offering. Paul said every week, week in and week out, get this ready. Don't wait till the last minute. Don't, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Some people, you know, if your niche provides for it, and you can, and you give once a month, that's your business. Some people, if they give once a month, they quickly don't give at all. But that's, again, it depends on the nature of the person's niche, how God provides for them, and all that sort of thing. F, grace giving with respect to the specific application of living grace includes the principle of equity. Today's giver may be tomorrow's receiver, and vice versa. That verse we have not seen, I don't think, 2 Corinthians 8, 13 and 14. And we are not socialists here. We are not here to make the rich equal with the poor or the poor equal with the rich. That is not our goal. And a form, and because of the nature of the niche and all that, in the initial stages, the church sort of practiced socialism. Now, we don't see that advocated throughout the rest of the Scripture as the norm. It was just what naturally and spontaneously occurred as believers hit their high water mark. As they got together and coming out of Judaism and all of that, they tended to want to share everything. 2 Corinthians 8, 13 and 14, for this is not for the ease of others and for your affliction, but by way of equality. At this present time, your abundance being a supply for their want, and their abundance also may become a supply for your want, that there may be equality. And again, we're not here to make people equal other than to the extent that giving is appropriate. One person has a need, another person can meet it. And again, a part of this is you have to learn to be humble. And there's a natural human arrogance that doesn't want to take anything from anybody. And some of that was ingrained in some of us from childhood. Stand on your own 2 feet, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, don't be beholden to anybody, as it were, and all that. And that's all good advice at a certain level. You should stand on your own 2 feet. You should be fiscally responsible. You should make applications. But there are times when the application is for you to receive, for you to be on the receiving end. And that requires humility. One can give and give and give and give and give. That's good. But there comes a time when you have to learn how to receive. And one should not be reticent to receive and recognize that it's all grace. And later on, you may be on the other end of the deal. The one who's giving to you now may be in need one day. Divide your portion to 7 or 8, for you do not know what misfortune may happen on the earth. G, for the pastor teacher, grace giving consists in continual sowing, in his continual sowing of spiritual things, while the congregation applies by sowing material things. 1 Corinthians 9:11. So we give and give and give and give and give. How do you give? Well, I give by constantly studying and teaching and promoting the spiritual side of life, the things unseen, keeping the focus straight, keeping the local church headed in the right direction, and all of that. That's what the function of the pastor is. If we sowed spiritual things, the communicator here, Paul and his party at that time, in you, is it too much that if we should reap material things from you? The implied answer here being no, it's not too much. That this is God's, in fact, this is God's plan. This is how God has worked this out. If others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right. And Paul said, in regard to the Corinthians, he never took money from them, but there were reasons. But he does not suggest, of course, that others do so. He says, look, I did this for a particular reason. It was my application and my choice. But he let the believers there be on notice that they were to support the further communicators that came their way, whoever they happened to be. So 1 Corinthians 9:11 there and Galatians 6:6. So we... And I haven't done the Galatians 6:6 passage. Stuart has done it. He told me there's a slightly different emphasis here, he thinks, than what this says on the surface. But since I haven't done it, I'm going to go with what it says here. Let the one who has taught the word share all good things with him who teaches. And this encompasses, of course, more than just money. This encompasses whatever blessings God may provide for you. And all of that, and you share, and you're generous, and all that. And most of you have done very fine in that regard. And again, I have no complaints. H, in the last days, many believers are preoccupied with money and the details of life, accumulating wealth at the expense of divine good production, or, God help them, even worse, not accumulating anything at the expense of divine good production. Just sitting at home this morning doing nothing. That's pathetic. Well, guess what? They're frittering away the time, and the time is quickly going. I don't see, we'll have to see how it all plays out, but realistically, we couldn't have too much more time here on planet Earth. The end has to be, you know, on the horizon. The world is being set up for this at every level. The insanity, the demonic infiltrations, the... nature of humanity in the last days, as we've been told. But 2 Timothy 3:2, for men will be lovers of self, lovers of money. And this gets into a whole laundry thing, but it starts out with lovers of self. Again, as we pointed out, that ultimately, selfishness is the enemy to much divine good production. Can't afford to be too wrapped up in yourself. And Revelation 3:17, as we know, the prophecy with respect to the Laodicean believers. Oh, they have plenty. They live comfortably in this world. They've got money in the details of life, but guess what? They're starving spiritually. And they're pathetic, as he says. You're pitiable. You're pathetic and poor and blind and naked. Well, that's how God sees them. How the world sees them is wealthy and prosperous. And that encompasses many believers who are not oriented to the truth any longer. Because money and the details became their focus. For some believers, it always was their focus. They never coughed up the reality out of their lives that the money and the details of life were not the most important thing. They never got over that hump. And you can go for years, and never get over that hump, but at some point you got to get over it. That money and the details of life is not the purpose of the Christian life. We recognize it's part of it, but that's not the focal point by any stretch of the imagination. So Revelation 3:17, because you say, I am rich, and I have become wealthy, and have need of nothing. Yet you do not know that you are wretched and pathetic and poor and blind and naked. And this is not a good assessment of a group of believers. And yet this is still a local church. This is still believers. And see, some of the fundies want to argue against that. These people couldn't be saved. Yes, they're saved. They're believers. They're just stupid believers. Very stupid believers. The believers that are nauseating, in fact, to the Lord. I will spit you out of my mouth. I will vomit you up. And at what on all that that entails, I don't know what that's going to translate into at the Bema seat, but I'll bet it ain't going to be pretty. Just using the physical analogy. And what sense of loss are these people going to have when it's all said and done? Well, then it's going to be too late. That's the whole point. We're constantly talking about the future like it's real. Like the Bema seat's actually going to happen. And the believers are actually going to stand there in shame. And I don't want to be one of them. God prosper some believers so they will be in a position to give generously. Each believer that has prospered must avoid the spiritual pitfalls associated with material wealth. 1 Timothy 6:17. And God will test you in some cases with the money and the details of life, and it is that. It is a test to see how you'll respond to it. And to see, how am I going to conduct my life now? And unfortunately, for some people, the reality is, as we all know, money and prosperity changes some people. Other people, it doesn't. Now, go figure. There are some people who can get wealthy, they can have plenty of money, and they're still the same person they were before. There are other people, if you gave them wealth, they become a monster. I mean, their priorities become skewed, everything goes down the tubes, and all that. Well, you don't want to be one of those. Instruct those who are rich in this present world. Now, again, you have to define, what's rich? What's rich in this present world? Well, by any standards, you and I enjoy a standard of living that is well beyond what most people on this planet have. And we take it for granted. We shouldn't. We ought to be grateful. We shouldn't take it for granted. We ought to be grateful and recognize, hey, I like indoor plumbing. Hey, I think that was a good idea. I'm for that. I'm for cars. Can you imagine if we had to get out here and you didn't have a car? How would we have Bible class? And even those of us who live, say, quote, in Sarasota, how far are we apart? What would you do? I mean, we'd have to find a central place, I suppose, and try to make it as convenient for everybody. But there are certain wealth, certain things that we have, and I'm glad we have them. I'm all for prosperity as long as it doesn't get in our way spiritually. I'm not against prosperity. Now, I'm not a prosperity preacher, but I'm not against it. You know, be like that guy in The Wedding Singer. Well, I'm a fan of money. I'd like to have some more, and that's where you come in. Give me a job. Well, I like money as well as the next guy does. Would you rather be rich or poor, Ron? Well, see, that's where the doctrine comes in, though. Because my answer to that is neither. I don't want to be overly rich or overly poor. Like the proverbial, the proverb there. Don't give me so much that I forget you. And don't give me so little that I steal and defame your name. I don't want to be either one of those. And I have found that, you know, if you do have wealth and all that, then you have to figure out how to be a steward of it. And that requires some time and some thought. You say, well, I'm going to put my money in the bank where it's safe. Okay. You'd be better off in a coffee can in your backyard. You do know that, right? Oh, no, you wouldn't be getting that 0.98% they're paying now. Well, let's see. I think the Fed should just start giving away money. They're pretty close to it now. Well, let's just print up some more monopoly money and everything will be fine. So again, you have to watch these things. So what is rich in this present world? Well, all of us are fairly well off. We're not hurting. Now, some of us may have more than others, but again, not to be conceited. That's the danger of the mental attitude arrogance that wealth spawns in some people. They give, as somebody told me, I was talking to, and this is a believer that wasn't even in this local church. He was a believer from some other local church. And I was talking to him once, and he pointed out, you know, certain people live in certain places because they choose to. Well, okay, yeah, all right. And he said, and certain people, you know, when they go to a certain place, he said, they're not just pursuing a bigger house or this or that. He said, they're pursuing a lifestyle that goes with it. And they want to hang out, they want to be associated with certain people. And they want to be in a certain crowd, the in crowd, the cultural crowd, the hip crowd, and all that. And I said, well, that's dumb. Why would anybody, you know, but people do that. He said this, and you know, he said, I've seen this multitudes of times. He said, people, and they're on, and that's always the drive for people, onward and upward. More wealth, more prosperity, more bigger house, bigger car. And again, I love that line out of the movie Wall Street. When is it enough? It's never enough. And it's never enough for some people. And they're never happy, no matter what they get. Well, unless they're crushing other people under their boot, that's what brings them happiness, the big deal, you know, no matter who suffers under it. Well, that's bad. So not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. Why? Because your riches can take wings and fly away. Anybody here lost any money in their IRA in the last year? Watch it shrivel down to nothing? Guess what? That's all manipulated by people behind the scenes that you'll never know or see or hear about. But somebody, where'd that money go, by the way, one may ask? That money didn't just disappear. Somebody pocketed a bunch of profits here and walked away rich. While, you know, people that say, well, and can you imagine if they'd have privatized Social Security and put it in the stock market? Oh, my God. We'd have been in a real mess there. Not that Social Security is a good product anyway, but still. We have to live with what we have to live with. So the uncertainty of riches. Riches have wings. They can fly away just like that. But on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Ah, life is meant to be happy and enjoyable, you mean? Yeah, under doctrine it is. And if you're patient and content and all those things, it doesn't matter what you have, does it? How much, how well, how little? Again, I've been through a lot of extremes. And, some people, you know, if you say, well, if you got 50 grand in the bank, you're wealthy. Other people wouldn't think they were wealthy unless they had 50 million in the bank. So God gives us all things richly. He supplies us with all things to enjoy for the purpose of enjoying them. Instruct them to do good, to keep their focus on divine good production, to be rich in good works, to be generous, ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future. And so this is the person who's got the real savings account. He's investing in heaven. And God pays an interest rate you wouldn't believe. And what he's going to have for those who do this right is beyond comprehension. So that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. The phase three niche that is has all the accoutrements that one would want. And we know from living on this planet, certain places are nice places to live. Sarasota. Anybody else want to be where it's 12 today? I don't. 17 below in International Falls this morning. Hey, let's go there. Rich was telling me yesterday somebody wanted to see snow, so they loaded up and drove north. God help you. You sick people. As he pointed out, you can turn on the TV and see snow. Just watch the Weather Channel. They'll show you all kinds of weather. Rain, tornadoes, hurricanes, snow. Whatever you want to see, it's there. All weather, all the time. Who would have thought it? So people can, they, you know, there's nice places to live. There's a nice environment, you know. I know we all are jaded because we've been here for a while. But you remember when you first got down here and you were at the Gulf every day, as much as you could get there, and you thought it was cool, and you know, you went, and, oh yeah, and it got old. And people come here now and spend $1,000 a week or more just to be here. And we're so fortunate we get to be here and get doctrine too. Ah, we are the blessed one. So avoid, you know, take a hold of that which is life indeed. And some environments, you know, certain homes are tricked out, we might say, just like cars are. And you want to have the ultimate in phase three. What would be the ultimate in transportation? I don't know. I haven't heard yet how we're going to be transported, maybe not need transportation. Some have suggested we'll be able to travel at the speed of thought. You'll just think, I want to be somewhere, and there you are. That'd be cool. I'd like to go see some, I like to snow ski today. Okay. There you are, snow skiing. And so, who knows how, you know, what to, but the residence that we see described, the New Jerusalem, is, I mean, it's beyond comprehension. It's described in terms of fabulous wealth and jewels and all these things that we, that are just obviously teaching aids to get us to understand the realities that are behind all this. So J, grace giving is proof of the fact that God's love is operative within us. 2 Corinthians 8:24 is therefore, openly before the churches, show them the proof of your love and our reason for boasting in you. And Paul essentially says, this Jerusalem offering is a manifestation of the fact that God's love is with, both within you, it's in you, as God's love is in all believers, but for some believers it's not operative in them, but it's operative in these believers. The God's love is operative as they manifest it by this Jerusalem offering, by giving, by money. So can money demonstrate your love for God? Yes, in the right context. But is God impressed with us or our money? No. No, not ever. I don't think so. Why would he be? Be like telling Bill Gates, you know, do you know what I have down here? Yeah. I got a boat. I'll bet Bill Gates has some nice boats. I haven't seen him, but I bet he does. I bet he's got some nice houses. John McCain doesn't even know how many houses he has. He's like Denny Crane. That's what that probably should have called him. Denny McCain. Doesn't even know how many houses he's got. Well, some people have more than others, we know. And then the 1 John 3:17, we saw love in deed and in truth, as opposed to just words and all that. Okay, well, back to Ecclesiastes here, after that review. And we now have some inevitable things and some random things. Guess what? Life is comprised of inevitable events that we can't change. And it's comprised of apparently random events that we have no control over. Isn't this book making you feel better about yourself? You're going to die. Life sucks and then you die. Things you cannot control, for Amelia and Alex. And there they go. And Solomon observes all this and he looks at all this. And as he comes down to the end of all this, as he begins to, again, he's starting to give more advice quicker. And he really gets into imperatives here in the last couple of chapters and justice forms. So if the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. If is the hypothetical particle here, im, I am. You can even translate it in a temporal sense, when. We wouldn't do any damage to it here. When are full, the Nifal imperfect is malet, M-A-L-E. Apostrophe. And that the Nifal is the passive stem, are full or are filled. The clouds is a definite article plus the masculine plural noun of A-B-H. Generally, this term is used of dark clouds, storm clouds that carry rain. So if the clouds are full, a rain shower upon the earth. You have a minimal sentence here in the Hebrew. Masculine singular noun of Geshem, which is the term for a rain shower. Upon, preposition ale, and here's ale is used in its normative sense, which means on, upon, or over. It has the spatial idea of above something or falling down on something, in this case, the earth. And then the word ale plus the word eretz, for earth. E-R-E-T-S. And whether a tree falls toward the south or the north. Wherever the tree falls, there it lies. So the hyphal imperfect here, third masculine singular of reek. Well, I'm sorry, I've got ahead of myself. The clouds are emptied out. That's the last verb here, R-I-Y-Q. That word means to empty something out, to dump it out. And so they've translated here, they pour out a rain shower upon the earth. And if, again, hypothetical, they've translated here as weather, because here it's got more of a actual event in view. As the tree falls, it falls. We realize that's a reality. It's an inevitable thing. But we have no control over which way the tree falls in a storm, do we? No, you don't. And if should fall down, and they translate here, whether a tree falls down is naphal, the verb to fall, N-A-P-H-A-L, falls down, and then the word etz, which means wood or tree, depending upon context. Tree is the view here. The word itself just means wood, and it comes to be used as a part for the whole tree. If it falls in the south, preposition bait here, they've translated it toward the south. You've got the word darom. That means exactly that. It's the word for south. Or, you got the wow adversative here, or if, again, the hypothetical particle im, if in the north, or toward the north, inseparable preposition bait plus the word sapon, T-S-A-P-H-O-N. Towards the north, we might say. In the place of which it fell, the tree, there it will become, is the literal Hebrew there. So the place is makom. That word means exactly that. It's just a generalized term for a place. Doesn't tell you about what kind of place. Which is the prefix relative particle sheen, and then you got nafal repeated again here, the cal imperfect. In a place in which it fell, it is definite article plus etz again, the word for tree. There, adverb of place, in that place, sham. There, it will become. And they've translated there it lies. It's just the verb to become, hayah, or hawa, actually, here. H-A-W-A-H. Usually it's hayah, but this is just an alternate spelling. It will stay. It will fall there, and wherever it falls, there it lies. Now, one might argue, well, you could go out and cut the tree up and move it. Well, sure you could, but that's not his point. It still fell where it fell, and you had no control over it. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. A cal active participle here of shamer, which means to keep watch or guard. So it has the idea of fastidiousness here, that this is not just a casual, you're just kind of glancing around. This is the person who, in an ongoing way, has his eyes, we might say, off in the distance. He's looking at that which is unseeable, at that which is really unknowable, and at that which doesn't matter. Because no matter how much you watch the wind, can you change the direction it blows from? And the answer is no. And watching the wind here is a phrase that is designed to essentially mean that he's not doing anything. He's not accomplishing anything. And again, the cal active participle here functions as a substantive. He who watches the wind, breath, wind, or spirit is ruach. The basic meaning of ruach is wind in motion. So that's how it's used. And in most cases, it means breath or wind. In some cases, it does mean spirit. So he who watches the wind, the one sitting around continually watching the wind, will not sow. Negative a negative low here plus the cal imperfect of Z-A-R-A-H. It's supposed to be a Z. So that word means to cast seeds. That's what it means. The word seed, zereh, is the word for seed. This means to cast seeds, to sow, to plant. And he who looks at the clouds, wow, here plus the cal active participle, again functioning as a substantive, ra'ah, the one looking at or watching, inseparable preposition bait here, which probably functions in this case as a direct object marker. And it can be used in that way. Bait can be used to indicate a direct object, to introduce one. And then you've got the word av again. The one watching the clouds will not reap. A negative low plus the cal imperfect of katser. Q-A-T-S-A-R. And that word means to exactly that, to reap. He goes into an agricultural, of course it was an agricultural, predominantly agricultural society in Israel. And one had to make sure that they spent the requisite time getting their plants in. and getting them in the ground first, planting them, and then bringing them into the barns. Point one, Solomon continues his thoughts about the uncertain nature of the world. Now, we've seen that the uncertain nature of the world is set for us very clearly in verse 2. You do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. You flat out don't know. What catastrophe could await us tomorrow? We have no idea. There was a Twilight Zone marathon on that I taped a bunch of them so I could watch them. And it was funny, you watch these, and of course these shows were back, you know, from the 50s and all, and so it was sci-fi, and some of it's kind of hokey. You look at it now and you think the special effects weren't all that great. Not like you can do now with, CGIs and all that, but the whole point is, I watch it, and there's always this sort of idea that catastrophe was looming over mankind. They kind of knew. And there was a lot of stuff in there about space travel and all of that. But the point was, they had a sense even then that war was inevitable. And it came across loud and clear in these shows that war was inevitable. And the fact is, we don't know what tomorrow holds. And they didn't know. And they, of course, in some cases, they played the worst case scenario and all that. So we got another example here. We don't know what misfortune is going to occur. So there's a place for legitimate prosperity. And again, I would say verses 1 and 2, one could easily make the application that this should govern your business acumen as well, that you try to diversify within prudence. But I think the biggest emphasis is on actually using your funds wisely in terms of true charity. So again, he continues his thoughts about the uncertain nature of the world by supplying two examples of things over which men have no control. The first example is from the water cycle and uses conventional language to describe the fact that conditions will come to pass that will cause rain to fall upon the earth. Not in Sarasota apparently, but I saw we closed another 2 feet down last year. That's 4 feet below average in the last 2 years. That's a lot of water being as gone. So what could be the next catastrophe here? Oh, we could have a problem with our water supply, let's say. That could be bad. So the water cycle, again, deals with this, and that rain occurs. Three, the second event is one from nature, which deals with the fact that when a tree falls in a particular direction, that direction is determined by forces we cannot control. And this is talking in general terms, of course. Obviously, can you determine how a tree falls if you're cutting it down? Well, you better be able to. You wouldn't have any business cutting it down if you don't know what you're doing. But yeah, you can control the way a tree falls if you're cutting it. But he's talking about an event in nature that over man, which he has no control. Forces that are at work beyond him. And the fact is, there are forces at work in this world that are far beyond us. Even just the natural forces in nature are often beyond our control. And then you have spiritual forces at work that we can't see even. And so this is, again, an object lesson that there are things out there that we just don't have any control over. And one has to sort of embrace this as a way of life. Hey, I can't control everything. And you have to recognize that. That's a part of being freed up. Some of us are more rigid than others. So some of us are more flexible than others. And the ideal would be to find that right balance between being rigid when you need to be and being flexible when you need to be. And that is a real art form, I think. So some of us like very fixed, structured. Others of us are just la, 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 big bird, you know. And, just go through life. And there, again, I think there has to be a balance here with that. Well, for the fact that both directions have a prefix bait, in with or by something, may well indicate that a south wind or a north wind caused the tree to fall in the particular direction that it fell. And some people will actually translate this when a tree falls because of a south wind. Okay, well, if it falls because of a south wind, it probably fell to the north. That's the only difference it would make here in terms of the overt representation of it. So I can see some people argue here because of the bait. They say, or if it falls because of a north wind, well, then it probably fell to the south. So I don't have any problem with that, and it doesn't really materially affect the interpretation here of what's going on. Five, some have argued that Solomon makes an assertion here that is palpably untrue. Since anyone could decide to move the tree to another place after it fell or simply chop it up. 6, it makes more sense to understand his point as a recognition that people do not have the ability to tell you which way a tree will fall in a violent storm. 7, both these examples serve to point out that there are certain inexorable events about which human beings can do nothing. And instead, I think one of the things that's come across, hopefully loud and clear in this book, is that Solomon has said this world is a vain place. It is a temporal place. It is transient. It is going by. It is happening. And there's all these things that happen out here, good things, bad things, mostly bad. And you're going through all this. And at a certain level, I think the goal of this book is to get you to embrace the reality that this is all true. And me to embrace it as well. That this is all true. This is a world over which we didn't choose to be born into. This is a world we were placed in. We better figure out how it works if we hope to be successful in this world. But the bigger question is being successful with God. And that's what we are to focus on. So at a certain level, you have to just kind of embrace the transience of things. That all these things do happen. And there are things over which we have no control. And that is designed, hopefully, to be somewhat liberating and recognize, you know what? God's got control, though. Even though I don't. I can't make people do what I want them to do. Even if it's in their best interest, I can't. And God doesn't do that either. He lets people run their way under their volition until they get to wherever it is they're going. And you have to allow for that too. Well, these both point out here that there are certain inexorable events over which humans can do nothing. 8, Solomon does not indicate whether the end result is good or bad. He simply makes the observation that these things can and do occur. 9, both these processes are governed by laws over which men do not have control. We can't really control the hydrologic cycle. There have been attempts to try to manipulate it. But if we could control it, we could make it rain wherever we wanted. We could make it snow in the winter up there and make sure the skiers always had snow. And we could stop flooding. Hey, we'll take the rain out of this area. The rivers are getting high. But we can't. So 10, as Wybrae has noted, the first figure very likely deals with the subject of inevitability, while the second figure brings the subject of the apparent random nature of events to the forefront. And guess what? There are two kinds of things in life. There are things that inevitably happen and you can't stop them. And there are random events which come to pass that you have no control over either. So 11, at this point, interpreters are divided as to whether or not the force of this verse is designed to complement the commands of the first two verses, or if they serve to introduce what follows. So 12, in the first view, the rain and the falling tree are taken to be unfortunate events for which one cannot prepare. Thus, they refer to the misfortune that may occur on the earth from the previous verse. That's one way of looking at it. Leupold, he gets a little far afield sometimes, so you really got to watch him. But he takes both these examples to be referring to God's judgment, which will fall at the appropriate time. That, to me, is not at all what he's getting at here. But just to point out that you may read some of these types of comments on this, and I think he's missed the point. So anyway, he suggests this has to do with judgment. I don't see a rainstorm being a judgment necessarily, or a rain shower. It's not even a storm per se. Or a tree falling. Is that God judging? Well, I don't see it, but again, he does. So 14, however, most interpreters understand this verse as a transition to verse 4, which deals with the necessity of human activity in spite of the many things that are beyond our control. And that's my view on it. That it's more a setup for what's about to come. That certain things, even though we can't control certain things, the emphasis here is on man's lack of knowledge and man's lack of ability to control things. And this is something that the human being has to come to grips with. I can't control things. I can control certain things. But about the best I can do is control me. And I'm not even that good at that. And most believers have figured that out. They recognize, oh, I got an STA, and it's dangerous, and I know I give into it sometimes, and I shouldn't, and all that. And so, you know, certainly you rebound and all that. But you come to recognize there are so many things over which we have no control whatsoever. And the only thing you can really control is yourself. And again, how many people do that perfectly? Well, nobody. So I think this is a transition into the emphasis being on the things we don't know. And he's going to say that here. In verse 5, you do not know the path of the wind. You do not know how bones are formed. You do not know the activity of God. Sow your seed in the morning. You do not know whether the morning or evening sowing will succeed. And I think these things are all designed to key into that thought that we don't know. And we don't know what's going to happen. And we don't. There are forces at work that are greater than us, and we can't control them. And we don't know how it's going to all turn out. So 15, actually, 14 here. Most understand this as a transition to verse 4, which deals with the necessity of human activity. So one might say, okay, so I don't know what's going to happen, and there are these greater forces at work that I can't control, therefore I don't have to do anything. Wrong. That's not what Solomon counsels. Solomon doesn't buy that. So 15, it is clear in the first two verses of this chapter that Solomon was counseling his readers to be appropriately cautious in light of the fact that the future is uncertain. And I think that's pretty straightforward there. There is an appropriate level of caution that one should exercise as he approaches life. Okay, I got to realize there are forces at work here that are bigger than me. I don't know what the future holds. So what is this? Okay, then some people would say, well, okay, because I don't know this, I can't do anything. Well, 16, however, he now moves to the point out that there is an appropriate form of caution, and there exists a dangerous form of behavior that may appear to be cautious, but is actually a form of laziness or stupidity. 17, obviously, many people get themselves into trouble by not being appropriately cautious. This is a characteristic of youth, particularly. But it doesn't always it's not limited to youth. Some people are not appropriately cautious. They do not wait until they have enough facts, and they often act impulsively and foolishly. Have you ever made the mistake of hearing a story, you jump to a conclusion, and you find out later, you know, I didn't have but half the story. And you feel like an idiot, and you stand there with egg on your face. Because you weren't appropriately cautious and didn't think, wait a minute, I need to see this thing through. Or I need to get the other side of this, or whatever. So some people see this ability. They think, okay, some real money to be made in Iraqi dinars. Now you can buy them for about a penny a piece, and they're going to be worth a dollar and a half soon. Well, you'd be a fool not to buy a bunch of them, wouldn't you? But you know what? They've been saying that now for about 4 or 5 years. I was kidding about it. I'm being facetious. This is all tongue-in-cheek. There's no money to be made in speculating on currencies generally. You can make it, but it's a risky business. And so this idea that all of a sudden the Iraq economy is going to turn around, the Iraqi dinar is going to be worth a dollar, and you only paid a thousandth of a penny for it. Well, that's a pretty good profit. Let's see. A thousandth of a penny. Rich, rich, rich. And the fact is, some people heard all this and they jump on the bandwagon. Now, that's the danger of people. They are impulsive and they can be stupid, and they hear something and they run with it and they don't bother researching it. And they say, you know, this is the greatest thing since frosted flakes. And then they start touting it to all their friends and they get involved with it. And next thing you know, you got Amway. And you got a multi-level situation set up where you're touting the newest, latest thing. And there's always a newest, latest thing. Have you ever noticed that? There's always a newest, latest thing. You know, you might buy a high-def 1080p TV. It's going to be obsolete in 2 years. They'll have something new. You not only will be able to see the pores, you will actually be able to see people at the molecular level. Now, that's a good TV. I'm being facetious, of course, but they're always promoting some new way to make money, some new way to get rich. Make millions of dollars from home by licking envelopes. Sounds good. How many do I have to lick? And can I use a sponge or do I have to lick every one of them? Well, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. But people are suckers for this kind of stuff, and they will jump on anything. You know, one time they had this breakthrough, they realized they could fill teeth with mercury. That was science at its best. And then they tell you, oh no, you know, now as it turns out, we probably shouldn't have put mercury in your head. Well, again, if people aren't cautious, there's a legitimate place where you have to say, you know what, we don't know what's happening. We ought to be relatively cautious, and there's nothing wrong with that. And some people just aren't. They just impulsively jump on every new thing they hear. It's called lack of discernment. And that's why they do it. So Solomon now, point 18, warns about the opposite danger. The believer that uses his ignorance as an excuse for inactivity. 19, verse 4, has the flavor of a proverb. Solomon may be quoting a proverb that was already in existence, or he may have coined a new thought here to make his point. But verse 4 seems to be, very much like the character of a proverb. It sounds very much like anything you would read in Proverbs, in fact. So 20, Solomon has already cautioned against the workaholic attitude, which often stems from the attitude of rivalry that seeks to have more or to outdo others. He's already warned about that. So we have these sort of boundaries he has established. Is the workaholic mentality good? Solomon would say no. It's not. 4:4. And I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. Now this too is vanity, fruitless, absurd, and striving after wind. So does he count? Okay, and he does exactly here what we've seen him do throughout this book. In verse 5, he counters that with the opposite. The fool folds his own hands and cannibalizes his own flesh. So on the one hand, Solomon says, look, a lot of these things that are done are really done with the wrong mental attitude and stem from STA activity. So therefore, we should do nothing, right? Wrong. The fool is the one who does nothing. He sits there and folds his hand. And the fool is in view, no doubt, in our verse. The one sitting there watching the wind. What are you doing? Watching the wind blow. How's it going? Fine. You going to get anything done today? No, probably not. The wind's always blowing. If you notice that, see it? You can sit, make a day of it. And so people do that kind of stuff, apparently. I mean, not literally. I don't think you're going to go out and find anybody doing that today. But this is a figure for just stupidly sitting there and doing nothing. So 21, in that context, Solomon informed his readers that there should be a balance between rest and work. We saw that, and he sets the example there that some of these things are done out of STA activity. Then he points out that the fool doesn't do anything, and then he provides the balance in it. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. So to know how to relax, when to take time off, everything. See, all work and no play makes everybody a dull boy. Not just Jack. Makes everybody dull. There's a point at which, go out and have some fun. Well, I don't know how to have fun. Well, learn. Find somebody that knows how to have fun and hang out with them then. Maybe they can teach you. So there's a place for hard work. We would know, and he's arguing for that certainly in our passage. That if you just sit around looking and you don't ever work, you're not going to get ahead in life. You're not going to prosper. So he's told us there should be a balance between rest and work. He tells us that in Ecclesiastes 4:6. Again, one hand full of rest. So 22, in the current context, Solomon moves to address the opposite problem. This is the type of person that does not take the appropriate steps when the time for action is upon him. Now you have, again, extremes in life that you observe in people. There's the jump and run idiot. It's new. It must be good. Go! And there's people that think like that. Well, they certainly act like that. So they must think that way. The jump and run type mentality. And then there's the person that just folds his hands and says, well, nothing's to be done. And so he's either lazy or stupid. Now, which one do you want to be? Jump and run or lazy and stupid? Neither. You want to be able to know when to act. And to act at the proper time. There's all this issue in here, as we saw there in Ecclesiastes 3, about this matter of timing, that God has all these times established. So there are times to do nothing. There are times to act, strike when the fire is hot. And that's from old metalworking analogy. Strike when the fire is hot. You can't wait. There's a time to act, there's a time not to act. See, knowing that if you knew always the perfect time to act, you could be great at the stock market, couldn't you? If you knew exactly the right time to buy and the right time to sell, you can make a fortune. And that's really all it is timing. But how do you know? Well, see, that's the thing. So we don't know all the time. We know that. We know that we don't know. But does that allow us to just sit around and say, well, Dennis, since we don't know, we can't do anything? No, that's not it at all. So there's an appropriate time to take action on certain things. There's an appropriate time not to. And one must know. 23, one question with respect to verse 4 is whether or not the subject is idleness in general, or simply the lack of action at the appropriate time. I think that tends to be the greater emphasis here, is lack of action at the appropriate time. Obviously, if a person's idle in general, one would expect that they're not going to make the right steps. That is probably a given. But the fact is, I think he's more emphasizing here, there's a right time to do things, and there's a time not to be lazy. There's a time for kicking back and putting yourself up in the hammock and swinging in the breeze. There's a time to be out planting and harvesting. So 24, it is clear that foolish people tend to focus their attention on things that are often not germane to the situation that is currently confronting them. Proverbs 17, 24. So the fool is easily distracted by all sorts of things. And because he's easily distracted and because he's a fool, again, he has a propensity to make wrong choices. And so he just continues this pattern that he has established. 17:24, wisdom is in the presence of one who has understanding. But the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. He's constantly looking off into the future to see that elusive happiness that he's going to find someday. And this is again one of the big lies in life that people have embraced, that it's all about arriving at a destination, and that destination is happy. Now, does everybody here want to be happy? Anybody here like being miserable? I don't. I've been miserable. I think it sucks. I do. And I've been happy. I'd prefer to be happy than miserable. Wouldn't you? Yes, of course you would. So how are we going to be happy? Well, the fact is, happiness, we believe, is found in this pursuit of doctrine. This is where happiness lies. You're not going to get up someday at 45 or 50 or 60 or whatever and say, you know, dang it, that's it, I'm happy. I'm happy from now on out. This is as good as it gets and it'll never get worse. It doesn't happen that way. It's not life. So again, the fool, his eyes are on the ends of the earth. He's got many grandiose plans and schemes. He's got it all, but, you know, he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, what's right in front of him. And then Ecclesiastes 11:4. That's our verse. He who watches the wind will not sow. Well, that means, doesn't that imply that there's a time for sowing that he should be sowing? And he's out watching the wind? And he who looks at the clouds, isn't it? Okay. Now, is there a time for laying out in the green grass and laying on your back and watching the clouds on a summer day? Yeah, probably. Yeah, I think there is. But is it all day, every day? Mm-mm. No, not by any stretch. And that really is best done once your other responsibilities are accomplished. Okay, well, our time is gone. We will stop there and continue on here Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for this time together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.